Right. I felt obliged to say something about spintronics in my talk, and having given a thought about it, I decided that it is really about spintronics what I'm going to tell about, not about real spintronics, but about pseudo-spintronics. The hero in that replaces spin in the discussion I'm going to make about electronic properties and quantum transport effects in graphene that replaces the spin will be the pseudo-spin which characterizes the block function distribution between sublattices in this material. And there is a lot of interesting physics which has similarity to the physics of spin in usual electron systems, which I would like to describe here. And also there are features that were absolutely unexpected for one with the spin physics background. That's what I would like to share with you, the relations to spin physics and quite funny differences. The work has been started initially together with Ed McKen, who is a postdoc at Lancaster. And then we started to get more people involved, Vincianov, who is quite known for exactly solvable solutions, joined this interesting topic. And my student, Konstantin Kachedi, is working on recalculation in graphene. And we have also been joined by external collaborators, by Tsunui Endo and Boris Altshuler, when we studied the weak localization effects in graphene monolayers and bilayers. The topic itself did not exist as a subject of an investigation 5 years ago, simply because the material that I'm going to talk about was not realized experimentally yet. The first time when there was a claim made that a single layer of graphite has been created, separated from bulk volume of graphite, contacted, and the electronic properties of this material have been measured, was only 2 years ago. This has been done in Manchester by the group of Andrey Geim. The guy who did most of the work is Konstantin Novoselov, who is also now in the staff of Manchester University. And the way how they created the system was that they became, in fact, serious. They took a pencil and they started to write a lot. And writing a lot produces a lot of flakes of graphite. And then Novoselov, who is a very patient man, you should meet this person to learn what patience means in practice. And he started to look for the thinnest films, and selecting the thinnest and checking how many layers are there, he was able to identify monolayers and bilayers. Since then, the interest to the system has been grown. And the first group which joined this effort, besides Manchester, was a group of Philip Kim at Columbia. And by now, both groups have managed to produce flakes and to process them into microstructures, making the micron size transistors based on graphene monolayers, or graphite monolayers, which is called graphene, and bilayers, measure their resistivity, realizing quantum Hall effect, determining the density, and doing low temperature transport measurements. The material on the start of all that is what everyone who is a theorist would think it is an absolutely theoretical material. It is what everyone has in pencil. And when I heard about this experiment, actually, I got involved into this business because I teach a postgraduate course at Manchester, and I had to travel there every Monday. And Andrei's group was very nice to me to accommodate me to have some coffee. And in exchange, I had to listen to what they have as their problems. And the first thing which we were discussing was actually how one can distinguish between what one can call a monolayer and bilayer on the basis of the experiments. And this is the thing I would like to finish with, if of course I'll have time, because the whole story started by our attempt to find the observable difference between a measurement in the monolayer and the bilayer, and what we came up with was the difference in quantum Hall effect picture of this, what can be seen in these two materials, in the monolayer of graphite and in the bilayer. However, the order how I structure the talk will not be that. First of all, I would like to explain the microscopic principles, starting from the tight binding model, and to explain that electrons and holes in graphene and in bilayers are chiral objects, and this can be characterized by the Berry phase J pi. And I'm not joking here, this J pi can have J1 or 2, and 2 pi Berry phase is not identical to 0, as I'll show you later on. Then I would like to explain how the chirality affects the transfer properties of two-dimensional electrons, and to talk a little bit about pseudospin and Berry phase, and also about the material-specific part of this system, the intervalley scattering, which affect the weak localization in graphene. And then, if I'll have time, I'll also say a couple of words about quantum Hall effect in monolayers and bilayers in relation to the Fani Landau level structure, which we identified in the bilayer system. Okay, first of all, I would like to start with this horrendous slide, which summarizes everything that people know about graphite, starting from old works by Slonjevsky and Weiss, which developed the tight binding model for graphite and introduced the parameterization of tight binding parameters. And all the way through, I'll use their notations and their way to look at the system. So when you construct the block function of the monolayer of graphite, you have to take into account that the this material, the monolayer of graphite, has a honeycomb lattice. The unit cell of such a lattice contains two atoms, A and B. So I just drew this hexagon to identify the A and B atoms in its corners, and the whole lattice will continue to be built of those hexagons. A and B are both carbons, so from this point of view they are identical. However, the way how the bonds which couple graphite together within the layer are oriented, you can see that this guy has the lambda-shaped bonds and B will have Y-shaped bonds, and as a result you can distinguish two sublattices from this principle. So now we have two sublattices of identical atoms. We have hexagonal lattice, and hexagonal lattice has a hexagonal shape of the Brillouin zone. And in graphite, and therefore also in graphene, the Fermi energy sits in the states close to the corners of the Brillouin zone, so-called K points. And there are two which are non-equivalent, which cannot be obtained one from the other by rotation by 2 pi divided by 3. You need to rotate by 60 degrees to get one from the other. And these two non-equivalent K points determine two valleys in the electron band structure close to the Fermi energy. So that's where one has to look at, and that are the values of the wave numbers in the band that one has to look carefully when describing those block states. The simplest approximation one can use when one describes the tight binding model of graphene is to take the coupling between two next neighbors. So that if I look at this picture of the lattice of graphene, then the couplings we are going to include throughout the talk as the main coupling mechanism determining the electron band structure will be the hops between the closest members. Therefore, this will be the hops coupling A sublattice to B sublattice. It is not all that what we did. We actually took the entire parameterization developed by Slonjevsky and Weiss and studied what are the effects of all other hops But because I know the answers, I'll concentrate on what is relevant, and I'm not going to be too general, just for the sake of fun of it. The parameter which characterizes the hop between closest neighbors from A to B sublattice is this parameter gamma node. And when one calculates the band structure, one has to take those block states where the wave number k will correspond to some proximity of one or the other k point. And then one has to identify the on-site wave functions where the sites can be from two sublattices, from A sublattice and from the B sublattice. And therefore, when one constructs the Hamiltonian describing the electrons, the sublattice index will appear as a matrix index in this description. And when we calculate the matrix elements determined by the strongest hop that we have, that there is in graphene between the AB sites, between the closest neighbors, then this will produce us the all diagonal elements in the Hamiltonian describing the electrons as plane waves. If we just do this numerical and plot some curves describing how the band structure looks like, if we just follow it through this cut of the Brillouin zone, then there will be two crossings near the K points, which identify a certain degeneracy in the spectrum, and which make the spectrum of the system close to the K points looking as if we have the gapless semiconductor with linear dispersion. So that's what I would like to explain in the next slide, where this linear dispersion close to the K points come from. And when we talk about dispersion, we talk about the definition of the valley as a proximity of one or the other K point. That's just because the Fermi energy will lie somewhere here. This comes from just counting the number of reliable electrons in the band structure. And then the wave number K will determine us the momentum which will count from the center of the valley. And we'll construct the Hamiltonian, and we'll talk about the Hamiltonian, which is expressed in terms of that momentum. So what we get here when we look at small values of the momentum P will be the description which is perturbative in terms of this small momentum. Of course, the expansion parameter will be the product of such a small momentum P and the period of the lattice, which is going to be a small parameter. And when we look at the proximity of the K point, what we have to do is that we have to take the matrix elements that would appear in the Hamiltonian describing the hops from A to B sites. We have to take the wave number close to the K point, and let's take it exactly at the K point. If we do that, then this phase factor will be related to the phases that we would identify if we draw the lines of constant phase passing through different sites from this sequence of A and B sites in the lattice. So if we take the center cut, the phase will determine as just equal to zero, so the phase factor will be one. And then if we go one step back or one step forward, then from the phase factor we calculate the phases which are e to the I 2 pi divided by 3 or minus I to e to the I 2 pi divided by 3. If we take the three phase factors and sum them together, we'll get zero. And it means that the K point is characterized by the decoupling of two sublattices, because if we sum three matrix elements which will describe the coupling of this A site to three closest neighbors, which will have the phases of the corresponding block functions which sum to zero, will have a complete decoupling. And this decoupling determines this degeneracy, the lack of the gap between what we would call the conduction band and the valence band. So we have extra degeneracy, which will tell us that in this spectrum of graphene, we have the fourfold degeneracy. We have twofold degeneracy between two K points. And also at each K point, we have the degeneracy between what we would call the electron band or conduction band and the valence band. Now, if we want to determine the dispersion, what we need to do is that we need to expand this all diagonal matrix elements that cancels at exactly the K point. We need to expand it around the k point, in the vicinity of the k point, in the small value of the momentum p, which disturbs the exact cancellation of these three phase factors. And when we do the perturbative expansion in the small momentum p, the off-diagonal terms that result from that will contain those pi and pi dagger operators, which are nothing but the linear combination of the x and y components of the small momentum p, which we count with respect to the middle of the value. And from now on, what I can say is that if we fix the value of momentum p, the hops between sublattices, or the hops from A to B sites, the hops between closest neighbors, for the electrons we attribute to one or to the other value, will be characterized by just this operator pi. And in terms of the electron Hamiltonian, which I now determine in the sublattice space, I get a 2x2 matrix. Of course, I'll have one 2x2 matrix for one valley, and there will be a similar matrix for the other valley. This parameter xi here identifies the valley index, so xi plus and xi minus will correspond to the left and the right-hand side valleys. And if I diagonalize this Hamiltonian, which is not very difficult to do after I write down it in terms of Pauli matrices, I'll find that the spectrum is linear, and it is very similar to the Dirac spectrum in two dimensions. So now I have the Hamiltonian, which describes what's happening inside one valley. I even can use the trick that experimentalists usually do, drawing those cones and saying that now we have the conduction band for positive energies and the valence band for the negative energies. And the interesting thing here is that the carriers, which you would attribute to the conduction band and to the valence band, are characterized by the electron chirality. So let me, using the analogy you can draw between all 2x2 matrices and spin, call the operator which acts in the space of sublattices. I'll call it pseudospin. It's not real spin, of course, because the transformation which is involved, it is the transformation in geometry, not real spin physics. However, because we have Pauli matrices, I can call it and use pseudospin and use all the properties we know about the operations with real spins. So here we have the electron, which will be characterized by that it will be at the positive energy, and we can call the hole or the valence band electron, which will be a state described by this Hamiltonian as a negative energy. And the difference between positive and negative energy will immediately fix the value of the projection of the isospin on the direction n of its momentum. So the electrons are those species which have this projection which is positive, and the holes or the valence band electrons are those guys which have this projection which is negative. So for the electrons, we always will have, so for states which are at positive energies, we'll always have the pseudospin direction oriented along the momentum of the electron. And this is a characteristic of the carriers. So if I propagate this electron, it will always have this property. If I scatter it, after scattering, it still will have this property. Otherwise, it would not be electron, and I wouldn't be able to violate this without changing the energy of the carrier. The thing which made this all interesting is that the material has been created and experiments have been made. And in those experiments, the way how the system has been studied was that such a monolayer of graphene, after being separated from graphite just by writing process and identified as a monolayer, has been deposited on the top of an insulating substrate. Well, the substrate was just the usual heavily doped semiconductor. In that case, it was silicon, N-type silicon. And on the top of this N-type silicon, there was silicon oxide grown. And the flake of graphene has been placed on the top of that silicon oxide. So there was the bottom part, which was heavily doped semiconductor, which was used as a gate. There was an insulating barrier. And then by playing with the gate voltage, one was able to change the density of carriers in this graphene monolayer. And also the same thing has been done as bilayer. And the density was changed from electron to the whole band. So the density was both positive and negative, and also almost zero. And it is a very flexible system to study. The graphene is very responsive. And also, it can be very nicely contacted by almost all metals without Schottky barriers, at least if there are some Schottky barriers, they do not display as huge resistances of the interface. And this diagram shows the room temperature to the low temperature resistance dependence on the density, and you also see that even at what would you call a zero density, this material still conducts, manifesting that there is no gap in the spectrum of this material. Now I'd like to talk about the property of carriers related to its pseudo spin and chirality. And as I said, the electrons in this material are characterized by the fixed direction of the pseudo spin on the direction of their momentum. And this cannot be negotiated. If we have an electron, it will always be like that. It is not like real spin, or you can say it is the limit of an infinitely strong spin orbit coupling in terms of the electron spin physics. So we talk about the electron, which always will have its pseudo spin directed along the direction of its momentum. And let's see what happens if such an electron propagates in graphene in the presence of some disorder. And realistically, most of the disorder in the devices which have been created by now, it comes from the substrate. What lies underneath this graphene is a heavily doped substrate with a lot of charge fluctuations. These charge fluctuations happen at the distances much longer than the period of the lattice of graphene itself. And as a result, what electron and graphene will see will be just potential modulation. And this potential modulation will not distinguish between A and B sides or even between two valleys. And as a result, in terms of metric structure, the disorder we talk about is just a unit matrix. As a result, this unit matrix commutes with the electron spin structure, and therefore you can say that the potential disorder always will conserve the electron pseudo spin. And then we have a funny situation. We have a carrier which has pseudo spin linked to the direction of its momentum, and we have disorder which cannot change the direction of pseudo spin. And this determines such a property that there would be no backscattering for such a carrier from a potential disorder. And again, this cannot be negotiated. So how does this happen? We would try to propagate electron, hit it with the potential step or some profile of potential distribution in the sample. We would like it to go back, and this size of the region where potential varies can be even smaller than the wavelengths of these electrons. From many point of view, you can say that this would be an almost delta function scatter. From the point of view of electron wavelengths, it is very short. You would expect that there would be some backscattering, however, not for chiral particles. Because if we would turn electron back, and if we would fly in the backward direction, it would have to change the direction of its momentum. But because this scatterer cannot change the pseudo spin at all, this scatterer, this electron, would have to be of the opposite chirality. But this cannot be, because then we would have to transfer the energy comparable to the Fermi energy and to transfer this electron to minus Fermi energy in the valence band, which is not good. This cannot happen. As a result, the backscattering is forbidden.
Which is principally possible then, for example, surface roughness, sort of really short range order on the substrate surface?
We'll talk about that a bit later, because this becomes important for recalculation. So everything which is disordered at the length scale of atomic sizes can violate pseudo spin conservation. And this is, of course, important, and this may produce backscattering. However, the dominant, well, in structures, in rubbish structures, which is the dominant source of scattering, comes from the substrate. But that's similar to the usual semiconductor. That's something which is very difficult to beat. If you want to have a transistor, you need to have a barrier, and this barrier will have a lot of built-in charge disorder.
Can I ask, maybe you answered it already, but I missed it. Why don't you get a Peierls distortion?
In where?
Well, because you have a linear dispersion, so...
It's linear dispersion, and the density of states is not sufficient to do that. When I'll talk about bilayer, if I'll have time to do that, there might be a question about that, but still there is something which, there is a small energy scale at which in the bilayer there is also a linear dispersion part in the band structure, and then this protects from instabilities.
Any temperature?
Hmm?
At any temperature?
Well, low temperature, I would say. So the infrared instability is cut off by that. So there might be some first-order phase transition which has not been seen experimentally and therefore ignored. Now, what I would like to use this idea about the lack of the backscattering, which was actually the thing which Ando came across first, is that if we talk about a device which would be the NP junction, the graphene-based NP junction, where it would have the electron and the hole region on the two sides of a region where the electron band passes through zero energy due to the variation of potential provided by the change in the gate from the positive to the negative in the hopefully possible split gate device. This has not been done yet, but that's what we are trying to suggest to experimentalists. Then the lack of the backscattering will actually take a even stronger form, because what we will have now is that electrons which would approach this interface at the direction perpendicular to the line of the NP junction, they would not be able to go back. They would be only able to pass through. So the electron from the conduction band would get through and become the electron in the valence band, or you can say that there is an electron and a hole coming together and recombining. But I don't like the language about the electron-hole recombination. And if we would talk about the structure NP junction created by means of external gates, the potential would be pretty smooth in the crossover part between the electrons and hole parts. And as a result, the passage through the interface would be permitted mainly for electrons which arrive almost perpendicular to the interface. Those which arrive at a certain angle, they can actually go back, and they actually have to go back. And this is because if we identify the momentum of the electron in the direction of the NP junction, parallel to the border between N and P regions, then we, in terms of the in terms of its dispersion as a function of momentum in the direction across NP junction, we will talk about some gap in the spectrum, the gap of the order of the velocity of the Fermi velocity in the kind of speed light in the cone of electron, multiplied by the in-plane component of its wave vector. And as a result, those electrons which would arrive at the angle which is large enough, they would be definitely returned back into the N region. So as a result, what we get is the transmission which is perfect for electrons which arrive perpendicular to the interface, and very poor transmission for electrons which arrive at the incidence angle, which is such that this product of pi, the width between the split gates multiplied by the electron wave Fermi wave number in the metallic part in the N or P side of the structure would be multiplied by this angle sine, square of sine of the incidence angles when this becomes large, or when this becomes at least of the order of one. Because we talk about smooth junctions, and smoothness here should be compared with the electron wavelengths in the N and P regions, we will talk about large value of this parameter, not even talking about the factor of pi. And as a result, the angles for which transmission would be sizable are very limited, so that the, as a function of the angle, transmission coefficient would have a very sharp maximum with the perfect transmission value 1 around 0. So we can use that to calculate such quantity as the conductance per unit length of the junction, per unit cross-section of the junction, and express it in terms of conductance quantum. Because it is conductance per unit length, the dimensions are 1 divided by the length, well, e square over h divided by the length. And we also can calculate the shot noise specific for such a junction, which has the universal Fanon factor, which is something of the order of 1/3 if we calculate this number, not exactly 1/3, but pretty close to it. And the selectivity of the transmission that I mentioned on the previous slide, the ability of only electrons arriving perpendicular to the junction to pass through it, is the result of the pseudo-spin chirality. So now we are using that to talk about some transport effect, so how this can be seen in the transport characteristics. And one point which becomes pretty obvious is that imagine we have studied the sample in the Krabina geometry. So this black spot in the middle is a inner contact of a small size, and it is surrounded by the electron region. Then we have the P region, so this is the NP junction separating white and gray, and then there is another contact outside, which is the metallic contact to the P region. And then if we inject electrons from the inner contact, of a smaller size inner contact, and if the size A of if the size of the inner contact is such small that the angles at which electrons injected by it would arrive to the interface is smaller than this critical angle, or typical angle within which transmission is perfect and beyond which transmission is exponentially suppressed, then those electrons emitted by the contact would pass the interface without seeing it, so that the interface between N and P regions would not generate any additional resistance. So now what we can do to violate this lack of reflection from the interface is that we can apply an external magnetic field. And then when we apply an external magnetic field, the electron trajectory would curve, and then by the time it arrives to the interface, the angle at which it appears at the interface would become larger than the critical angle for the perfect transmission. So this angle can be estimated as a ratio between the radius of this NP circle as compared to the cyclotron radius determined by the magnetic field, and then we can introduce such a scale of magnetic field B star, which will be that the angle at which electron will arrive to the interface due to the curving trajectory by magnetic field would be of the order of the critical angle for the perfect transmission. So if magnetic field exceeds this value B star, then the angles at which electron would arrive to the interface would now be such that the transmission would be very poor, so that electrons would be reflected back into the N region. And then they would spend there a lot of time until they relax their momenta, and eventually they would arrive to the interface being able to pass. And then it would mean that we have acquired extra resistance, because now the interface will contribute the additional value to the resistance, which will be determined by the conductance per unit length of the interface, and of course by the perimeter of the circle separating N and P regions. In terms of observables, we're talking about magnetoresistance with a typical scale of B star. And if we take micron size geometry and estimate magnetic fields from knowing the parameters and talking about the electron density of the order of 10 to the 12, which is typical for those devices which have been created by now, then we would have the magnetoresistance developed at the scale of magnetic fields on like 0.1 Tesla, which is quite realistic in the experiment. We can come up with other geometries where such an effect would take place, the magnetoresistance due to the selective transmission of NP interface. And this is another example where such thing can happen. For example, we would take a device where the P region is in between two N regions, and the interfaces that we're talking about are parallel to each other. So this would be NPN junction or part of some super lattice, or you can call this, or that's what you would call in the normal semiconductor physics, a quantum dot. Or not quantum dot at the moment, just a dot. Then what we have, if there is no magnetic field, is that those electrons which pass through the first NP interface, when they arrive to the next one, they are already in the condition of a perfect transmission, because if they manage to pass the first interface, it means that they arrived and passed it at the angle which is perpendicular to it, and if these two interfaces are parallel to each other, then it will pass through the second as well. However, if we apply magnetic field and curve the trajectory, then those electrons which pass the first interface will arrive to the second, if magnetic field is larger than this B star, they will arrive to the second at the angle that perfect transmission will not take place, so these guys will go back and go back into the N region. Or those which would be able to arrive to this interface, to the second interface perpendicular to it, would have to start around here near the first one at the angle which would not correspond to the perfect transmission, and this would mean that this would be electrons which already wander around in this region. As a result, as a function of magnetic field, the conductance of the NPN junction would now acquire extra dependence on the magnetic field, which develops on the scale of B star, and which would reflect the selective transmission through the interface. So electrons that we would have here, or after this double selector, would be those which both travel perpendicular to the NP junction, and also they would have their isospin perfectly aligned along the direction of propagation. So this is a very rare situation when you can produce fully polarized carriers just using geometrical factors. However, as I said, it is not a real spin that we're talking about. It is not the same as producing fully polarized spin of electrons, because this is not real spin. This is a pseudo spin. The electrons, they always have it parallel to the direction of their propagation.
In that configuration, I guess the size of the N junctions are also parameter as well, right?
The size, yeah, the smoothness of the junction is. And of course, the length of the junction is.
So also, when you're injecting them, they ultimately bend the magnetic field in the length of the N junction, right?
No, the width of the junction itself is much smaller than the distance between. Yeah. So we consider it something of the micron size, and we think about the width of the junction of the order of 1,000 angstroms, because that's determined by the distance to the gate.
I missed something in the explanation. You emphasized previously that the pseudo-spin cannot change, which is why you cannot just reflect on a general potential. But here you now have a mechanism by which most electrons do reverse direction, so the pseudo-spin must change. So why is that not in conflict with the previous statement that the pseudo-spin cannot change?
Well, the point here is the following. When you arrive and scatter, you're not really at this, in this region, you do not really scatter backward. You scatter at a finite angle. And if I draw the diagram that only half of you will see, so this will be the direction of propagation. This will be the angle to which I would scatter. Then the typical diagram, and this length would be the probability to scatter to a certain angle. The probability to scatter will look like that. So the scattering backward from a defect is suppressed. The scattering backward, exactly backward, from the interface is also suppressed. However, if you need to scatter to a finite angle, you still can do that. So this is what's happening here. And because you because it cannot scatter in exactly backward direction, and because this is a flat interface, the only possibility is to pass through. But if you arrive, if electron arrives at a finite angle, then it can share the amplitude of its wave function between the part which will pass through and the part which will be back, which will scatter back into this end part.
Is that possible? This interface has to be aiming for this to make sense.
Another answer, which only half of you will see. If the interface is a step-like, then the scattering probability is cos square theta divided by 2. So the width of the spike, the selectivity, depends on the smoothness of the interface. Some reminiscence of this ballistic effects would exist even if you have the interface as short as the electron wavelengths. But what is needed is to have the smoothness, or the distance between split gates, which is longer than the wavelengths of electron. And this is not very difficult to achieve, because electron densities I'm talking about are 10 to the 12, where the typical widths of the insulator used in this in these devices and the transistors made of graphene, it is about 1,000 angstroms. So this would be parameter of the order of 10. I'll talk about this in two slides, if you don't, or three, four slides, if you don't mind. If there will be intervalley scattering, if this interface would contain atomically sharp defects, like you would just cut off one of carbon atoms, or you would replace it with a substitution, then it would scatter between valleys, and it would not conserve pseudospin, and it would be able to scatter backward. And then, of course, we would have this beautiful picture slightly suppressed, so that the probability to scatter... Yes. And
Do you assume some particular crystal axis orientation in that picture?
No. The linear dispersion is isotropic.
How good is the assumption for that assumption?
That's coming.
Look at the interaction between the wheels.
Let me do that. I'm skipping everything about bilayer, because I think we're now... No, I can't skip everything about bilayer. Let me go quickly through the bilayer, and then I'll answer all the questions about extra terms in the Hamiltonian, which I have not shown yet. I'm afraid I don't want to dig into your time. So let me describe bilayer. I'll get the bilayer Hamiltonian, and then I'll add terms to the monolayer Hamiltonian, which will be similar to what I'll get in the bilayer, and we'll talk about symmetry a little bit, and then I'll jump into conclusions about other types of scattering. So here is a bilayer, which is made of two monolayers. In graphite, the pair of layers are not arranged that each A atom is above A atom and each B atom is above B atom. It is called Bernoulli stacking, which is shown here. And in this stacking, the B atom from the top layer is above the A atom in the bottom. Or no, the A atom in the top layer is above the B atom in the bottom layer. And this hop between two layers, between B in the bottom and A in the top, is the strongest hop. And the other atom in the honeycomb lattice does not find the next neighbor just underneath it. So, for example, this guy is above the center of the hexagon here, and that guy is underneath the center of the hexagon in the top layer. So that these two are virtually decoupled, at least in the approximation when we take into account the strongest hops. And of course, we can take into account weaker hops when necessary to amend the Hamiltonian, which will describe the bilayer system more realistically. So the first thing we need to do is to construct the Hamiltonian, which will now contain two layers. Therefore, I have not only A and B sides, but I also have those sides with tildes, which identify the A and B sides from the top layer. And A and B belong to the bottom layer. And the way how I arrange it, A, B, A, B, is just a matter of choice. So that the pair which is stronger coupled, the pair which contains, which will be coupled by the strongest coupling, the A tilde and the B atom, the ones which are underneath each other, I'll just order the amplitudes in such a way that they will stay close to each other, and two disconnected, they stay as the other two indexes. And the first thing we should do is that we should include in this Hamiltonian the hops within layers. And as I said, we describe all the hops that happen for states close to the k points. And as a result, the hopping element will contain this linear combination of px and py, the x and y component of the electron momentum calculated with respect to the center of the valley. And these off-diagonal terms, they characterize the hops which happen separately in each of those two layers. We also can include the hop between layers, the strongest one. And this is already enough to talk about the properties of this Hamiltonian. There are, of course, weak hops between pairs of atoms which do not see each other directly. But because we know the numbers for bulk graphite from this Slonjevsky Weiss parameterization, we can estimate that this is much weaker, and we can take this simplified Hamiltonian as the first approximation to talk about. Then if we look at this Hamiltonian, we realize that there are, in the back structure, two types of bands. There are two bands which are indicated here with blue, which have been split apart by the amount of the interlayer coupling, by the hop, which in Slonjevsky parameterization is called gamma 1, the hop between, the vertical hop between two closest neighbors. So those bands are based upon what we would call dimers, the states which are shared by A and B atoms which are above each other.
Where is the PZ band?
So these are two pi bands which are known to be responsible for the conduction properties of bulk graphite. And all the other bands, they appear at much higher energies, and therefore we don't have to include them. So the scale of energies here is 0.3, 0.2, 0.5 of electron volt. And all the other bands are at several electron volts apart. Now, and there is also the, so there are bands which are based upon the, what I would call dimers. And there are also bands which are based upon the sites which do not couple directly to each other. And these are the bands which are shown here in red, which have quadratic dispersion, and which also touch each other, forming a gapless semiconductor properties of this material.
This gap would be, if you take this next nearest neighbor's interaction.
This gap, no. The gap will never happen if we don't violate hexagonal symmetry. So the gap is protected by hexagonal symmetry, and this is a beauty. And it will be the same symmetry as in the monolayer, because if you look on the structure from the top, then you can identify that there is this double side where A and B are, this double side where A and B are above each other, and then along the perimeter of it, or going around it, you will have a hexagon which contains the pairs of sides which do not couple to each other directly. And then if you want to go between the sides which do not couple to each other directly, like this or those, in this approximation we are talking about, the way to travel is that you hop within the layer for which you use the matrix element of this pi operator. Then when you appear at one of those sides which form a dimer, you will have a gap in the energy. So there is energy deficit that you cannot overcome, but electron can occupy the sides virtually, sharing its amplitude between them. And this virtual occupation will take at the time scale of gamma 1 to the minus 1. And then as it is now shared by two layers, it can continue to hop, and it will hop to the B tilde side with the amplitude of pi. As a result, the hop from here to there will contain the product of two pi's and the Hamiltonian that will attribute to the slow energy bands, which will be now again 2 by 2 Hamiltonian in the space of B tilde and A sides, will contain pi square and pi dagger square instead of pi and pi dagger as we had in the monolayer. So we got the Hamiltonian which looks like a Dirac Hamiltonian, except that what stands on the off diagonal parts is quadratic in the momentum operator. Of course, this is an approximate result. It includes only the strongest hop which are between layers and within layers. However, it can be used to discuss the properties of this bilayer graphene at intermediate energy scales, not, or intermediate momentum scales. Not very small, because that's where we'd have to include some linear terms that would appear due to the direct coupling, which is much weaker between A and B tilde sites. And not at the energies, of course, where we would have to talk about the bands which have been split. But these are pretty high energies according to what the ball graphite properties say. And then we have this intermediate momentum range covered by the quadratic Hamiltonian, which can be compared with the monolayer Hamiltonian. They are quite similar, except that this guy has pi square and pi dagger square. And they will have quite an interesting similarity in the properties of carriers. As I explained, the electrons in the monolayer are chiral, and in the same way, the electrons in the bilayer will be chiral. Because I can take this Hamiltonian, and I even can generalize and consider them together with some number j here. J in molar is 1, and the bilayer is 2. I can write down px plus ipy as momentum absolute value multiplied by the phase factor, which tells in about the angle in the direction of the momentum calculated, let's say, with respect to the x-axis. Then I can rewrite this Hamiltonian as the energy scale multiplied by the matrix structure, in which I have a unit vector which is directed in a way dependent on the momentum. But for the bilayer, it will not be directed along the momentum. I have to calculate this direction by turning the momentum direction by the angle phi from the x-axis and turning the direction n for the polarization of the pseudo-spin by the angle j phi. So if I rotate the momentum with the speed of omega, the vector n will turn with the angular speed of j times omega. So I'll talk about the particle with chirality of the order of j, if you permit me to use this term. Such a chirality may be also associated with the Berry phase, which is equal to j pi. And the way how we can do that is the following. Let's imagine some adiabatic propagation of electron, or we can say the change of parameter, which is n, adiabatically just by hands, or we can imagine that this is electron propagating along a cyclotron orbit. And then the direction of the quantization of the pseudospin will rotate by the angle of j times 2 pi if the direction of momentum will rotate by 2 pi, which will correspond just to the closed loop. Then we can calculate what does it mean for the spinner in the A, B, or A, B tilde basis. And this spinner will have to rotate around the third axis, because this direction is always in the 2D plane, by the angle of J times 2 pi. And according to the spinner algebra, or algebra of Pauli matrices, this will be the same as just multiplying the wave function, which has arrived to the initial point with the same direction of momentum by the factor of I j pi. So for monolayers, this j is 1, so we're talking about the very phase of pi. For the bilayer, j is equal to 2, so that we would be talking about the very phase 2 pi. And in literature, it is very often that people prefer to kick away this very phase 2 pi, just ignoring its importance.
What happens on tri-wing?
Rubbish. So eventually, you need to end up with the bend structure, which is some metallic bend structure of bulk graphite, and that's in trilayer is actually the first real step towards it. So really, it's rubbish, and I don't want to talk about it. So Berry phase is an interesting object, and it has consequences for transport characteristics. So if I'll have 10 more minutes, I will cover it. Do I have that? Do I have 10 more minutes?
Yeah, sure.
So what we have identified in the previous slide is that the monolayer and the bilayer can be characterized by the Berry phase pi or the Berry phase 2 pi correspondingly. And in the transport characteristics such as weak localization, the Berry phase pi is usually associated with anti-localization, and the Berry phase 2 pi, which is would be equivalent to the Berry phase 0, can be associated with weak localization properties of the carriers. So what I would like to say now is that this is a very simplistic view, and that the material signs, such as the real symmetry of the K points and terms which are missing in this two Hamiltonians, will actually change those two assumptions. Before I do that, I would like to run through a quick explanation where this relation between Berry phase and chirality and the weak localization and anti-localization come from. So let's talk about weak localization or enhanced backscattering first, and then we'll talk about some wave which propagates along the path which has this closed loop embedded into it, or as a part of it. And then there is a clockwise and anti-clockwise possibility for this wave to propagate. And if the system is time reversible, these two phases are equal to each other. And then if we take the modulus square of the sums of clockwise and anti-clockwise amplitudes acquired along these two passes, then when we open modulus square, we'll have the modulus square of each taken separately and the sum of the products, which is actually equal to the sum of moduli if the phases of the clockwise and anti-clockwise propagation are identical. And as a result, we'll have the twice enhanced scattering in the exactly backward direction. For the chiral electron, chiral with its pseudospin linked to the direction of propagation, we also can talk about the interference contribution. We enter with an electron with pseudospin directed along the momentum, so along the x-axis. This electron will undergo full revolution and come out with its spin directed in the opposite direction. Or we can enter with electron with a green pseudospin directed to the right, encircle the same loop in the opposite direction. Again, this electron will come out with the same direction of its pseudospin as the electron going in the clockwise direction. Therefore, they will interfere. But this interference will be destructive instead of the constructive interference for the spinless case. And this is because when we compare the phases, which are acquired by the spin half particle when its spin direction undergoes clockwise and anticlockwise revolution, because of spin half, the change in the direction by the angle of pi, and therefore the angle of 2 pi in their relative rotation, will convert into the e to the minus I 2 pi divided by 2, which is pi factor, in the wave function. As a result, the red wave and the green wave will come out with the opposite signs. And therefore, the interference, which was for spinless particles constructive, will become destructive. And as a result, there will be a completely suppressed backscattering disk. And this is exactly the same suppression of backscattering that I talked about in terms of the chiral electron, which undergoes scattering from the pseudo-spin conserving potential. Because all the way through this discussion where we propagated the electron on the closed loop, we do not permit the violation of the isospin conservation, and we also did not have any possibility to scatter between two values, because in this picture there are no values yet. So that's to explain why I said that the baryphase pi related to the chiral particles, or baryphase 2 pi, can be assumed to produce weak anti-localization or weak localization. And for baryphase 2 pi, I would have to substitute phi equal to 4 pi and get the minus I 2 pi factor, which is equal to 1, and I would return back to the picture where the backscattering is enhanced. However, in the reality, both in the monolayer and in the bilayer, extra terms have to be added, reflecting the fact that the symmetry of the wave vector k is actually lower than the hexagonal symmetry. It is an effect of trigonal warping, known very well and studied very extensively in bulk graphite in 70s and in 80s. So the terms which are added to the major terms in the monolayer, these are the terms which result from other hopping processes, as well as in the bilayer, these are the terms which are generated by the hoppings by the hopping between sites which are not directly coupled, which are not above each other. These terms can be treated as weak perturbations from the point of view of the energies. However, they play an important role in the symmetry analysis, which has to be taken into account when one converts the Hamiltonian into the observable quantity such as weak localization. The thing that this term does, for example, to the shape of the Fermi surface is that for 2k points, and this is taken into account by the fact that this term has the number plus or minus 1 as a factor, depending on which value we're talking about. If I draw the shape of the Fermi surface in the corners of the hexagon, then on one side it will resemble slightly deformed circle, deformed into the form of a triangle, or trying to deform it towards the form of a triangle. And in the other, it will be a triangle of the reverse direction. As a result, if we just stick to one k point separately, what we'll see is that the dispersion is not inversion symmetric with respect to the center of the valley. And you can say that I have effectively violated the time reversal symmetry related to one single valley separately. So that the dispersion at the wave number, at the momentum p, will not have exactly the same energy as at the momentum minus p. Of course, there is time reversion symmetry in the system, because when I inverse time, I have to go from one valley to the other valley, and then I also have to flip the thing, and then the real time inversion is not violated at all. And a similar thing happens in the bilayer if I take into account linear term working together with a quadratic term. This linear term is important for very small momenta, therefore at very small energies and densities. But if we talk about high densities and 10 to the 12 inverse square centimeters in terms of density is already enough that for energies this term is the dominant. However, this guy will play the same game and will produce a trigonal warping disturbing the time reversal symmetry treated separately in each of the bands, in each of the k points. What does it give in terms of weak localization? We calculated the weak localization correction to the conductivity. both in the monolayer and in the bilayer. And as usual, one does this, one expresses it in terms of Couperons. And now Couperons have extra discrete quantum numbers, which are related to the valleys. So we have the valley-valley term, so intra-valley Couperons. And as I said, in each valley separately, if I don't mix valleys, if I don't scatter between valleys, I'll have no effective time inversion symmetry in each of them. And therefore, those two Couperons will be suppressed due to the additional terms that can be treated as a perturbation. But now I have to treat them as a perturbation on the time scale or on the energy scale related to the mean free path time, which may be pretty long. And therefore, those terms will start manifesting themselves in the suppression of the intra-valley Couperons. Now, there are also two inter-valley Couperons, which are due to the pairs of electron states taken from two valleys separately. One of them would be symmetric in terms of valley indices, and the other would be antisymmetric. And if we would not have any intervalley scattering, then what would happen is that these two guys would simply cancel each other. And this is a similar effect that one has when studies the weak localization for spin half electrons. There are three Couperons, which are triplets. There is one which is singlet. And usually they come with opposite signs. Here we have something very similar. We have three with pluses, one with minus. So this is the most symmetric. We can call it a singlet. And these three, they effectively form a triplet, of which this pair, and also in the bilayer, this pair will be suppressed by the intra-valley properties, the intra-valley lower symmetry of the wave vector. So these guys will disappear if we take into account the trigonal warping. And actually, these are the two guys which would be responsible for the Berry phase effect and for the weak anti-localization as manifestation of a possible Berry phase effect. And after we take into account this lower symmetry of the k-point, what we'll find is that the initial assumption that chirality and the Berry phase would immediately manifest itself in the weak anti-localization in the monolayer and in the weak localization in the bilayer is gone. There is nothing left of it. However, there is an interesting observation we can make, which is that now we have two Couperons left, which in the absence of the intervalley scattering would completely cancel each other. And this would happen both in the monolayer and in the bilayer. And as a result, the prediction we can make is that one would not see any weak localization. One would measure weak localization, lower temperatures, no weak localization at all, no magnetic resistance specific to weak localization, even if on the background there would be pronounced conductance fluctuations indicating that phase coherence is preserved. There is no inelastic processes involved. What else? You asked about intervalley scattering. If there is intervalley scattering, or if we'll have edge in a wire which scatters between valleys, then the antisymmetric Couperon will actually die out. It will acquire a gap in the relaxation spectrum determined by the intervalley time. And then the only thing which will be left will be the symmetric intervalley Couperon. And both in the monolayer and the bilayer, the symmetric intervalley Couperon produces negative contribution toward the weak localization correction, the same sign and the same size as you would expect in the usual electron gas. So the difference between usual electrons is and electrons in graphene is actually in a possibility that we can have a regime when the tau phi is shorter than the intervalley time, and as a result, the magnetic resistance would not display any weak localization effect at all. And you also can say that if you look at a given structure, you never know in advance what exactly you're going to expect. So now we have two possibilities. One possibility is that in a structure where the time, intervalley time, is long enough, longer than tau phi, then magnetic field dependence of resistivity would not display any magnetic resistance related to weak localization. You can change temperature, this will stay the same. However, if the intervalley time is short enough, shorter than the tau phi, the lowest temperature one can measure, then there would be some weak localization peak at small magnetic fields, which will be eventually strongly cut off at the magnetic field scale, where the flux quantum would be provided through the area determined by the diffusion length at the time of the intervalley scattering. This is slightly different from what we're used to in the weak localization measurements in general, because in weak localization, such a logarithmic dependence in the 2D system would persist to the fields related to the length of the mean free path. And here, it is happening, this cut happens at the scale much, at the magnetic field much smaller than what is determined by the elastic mean free path. And what I also would like to say is that the same picture would repeat itself in the bilayer case with exactly the same consequences. So if there is no intervalley scattering, we would not expect any weak localization effect. These two couprons would cancel each other. If there would be sufficiently strong intervalley scattering, we would have the magnetoresistance manifesting the weak localization, which would be cut short at a relatively small magnetic field scale. And therefore, the size of the spike in the weak localization magnetoresistance, which can be determined as the difference between zero and high magnetic field value, would be reduced. So we can say that the weak localization magnetoresistance is, or weak localization effect is partially suppressed. Now, as I said, when one has a structure, one never knows what exactly one studies, whether the intervalley scattering is strong or weak. And it was quite a nervous exercise for me to deal with my experimentalist colleagues in Manchester, because they actually saw both types of results. They saw both structures which produced weak localization spike in the magnetoresistance with the conductance fluctuations shown on the top of it, as well as other structures which had pronounced mesoscopic fluctuations, the reproducible pattern of magnetic field fluctuating resistance. However, no observable effect of the weak localization. So these fluctuations happen on the top of the constant band graph. And in my view, it is a manifestation of what I just explained on the previous slide. And it was even a reasonable relation between when this or that effect has been seen, because the structures which did not show any weak localization at all had those, they looked like bubbly structure. It looked like the surface of graphene is the set of many bubbles. As a result, it touches the surface of the substrate in a small number of points. So it is loosely coupled to the substrate. So if you take graphene and press it hard to the substrate, you will have two incommensurate lattices which are close to each other. Therefore, a lot of intervalley scattering due to sharp atomic size disorder. However, if you will have a suspended graphene sheet, then no intervalley scattering will take place, because graphene is a very immune system in terms of atomic defects. It's very difficult to inject something, to substitute or to create a vacancy. And if it is loosely coupled or it is suspended, then I would expect no intervalley scattering happening, and as a result, no weak localization manifesting in the magnetoresistance measurement. I think I have finished after such a long time without touching the issue of quantum Hall effect. So those who are interested may come and ask what these slides which I'm skipping are about. And I just would like to say that also due to this two types of chiral Hamiltonians, and due to the fact that magnetic field determines magnetic length, and this determines the typical scale of momenta where one has to worry about the dispersion of electrons, by taking structure into a Hall field, one can provide that the quadratic Hamiltonian for the bilayer I have shown you before, which corresponds to the quasiparticles with Berry phase 2 pi m with degree 2 of chirality, would be the dominant part in the Hamiltonian for single particles you would have to worry about. And then the Landau-level structure manifests the presence of this baryphase and produces a double degenerate Landau-level at zero energy, which in quantum Hall effect measurements has manifested itself as a double step in the quantum Hall plateau jump, well, there's a jump between two quantum Hall planets as compared to the monolayer. And this double step happens across the region of zero density and has been observed experimentally in the measurement where the density at high magnetic field has been varied and quantum Hall effect plateaus have been detected, and then the monolayer structure and the bilayer structure have been compared.
Is this an experiment or a theory?
I especially included the previous slide to show that there was an experiment done on a realistic structure and really resistances were measured leading to the next slide, but I have skipped that. So this is the experiment, and all what I skipped before was the theory. So I'm finished. So I would like to thank Gary that he permitted me to talk about pseudo-spintronics instead of spintronics. I think that the word spintronics covers so many areas that it now means something interesting about spin. So just take the word pseudo-spintronics as something interesting about pseudo-spin. And I think that there are many funny things happening in graphene which make it different from usual electron systems. We have already gone through those few examples where the pseudo-spin and electron chirality did matter for transport characteristics. We have also done work with Vadim Chiyanov studying the Friedel oscillations in graphene, and they look quite funny and different from usual electron gases and semiconductors also, both in terms of what the oscillations look like and also in terms of observable effects and the resistivity. And I think the topics of the quantum Hall effect in graphitic monolayers and bilayers, including interactions, is something which will flourish in the next couple of years. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you very much. Thank you very much. So this is my Hamiltonian with a baryphase J-pi. So I took freedom to generalize without any material basis for that. And what I do, I find the Landau levels. Now baryphase, when you use the word baryphase, you have to be careful. The baryphase has very well defined, is a very well defined quantity when you talk about semiclassics. But when you do semiclassics, you can study the distance between levels, but you can't say it really what's the lowest energy state. So there is very little you can say on the basis of baryphase analysis as a semiclassical object if you talk about the lowest energy state. However, we have the Hamiltonian, which describes those chiral electrons for which baryphase J-pi is a specific mathematical property. And we can find the exact spectrum of this Hamiltonian. It's not a big deal. What is important on this slide is that now we have J time J states, which will have exactly the same energy equal to zero as eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian. So what this phi with index n means? It means the nth Landau level function. And if I take j different states which have zero in one component of the spinner and have one of those Landau level functions from zeros to up to j minus first, they all will correspond to the energy level zero, because if you act with the descend Landau level descending operator to the j power on either of those, you will get zero. So this is the degeneracy, which is the result of the chirality of the order of J. I can only speculate that this is a mathematical representation of the pi J pi baryphase. I try to imagine it as two presses which are turned in the opposite direction on the electron and the whole side squeezing spectrum towards zero, and each time when you pass pi you get one extra state at zero energy level. However, I don't think that this has too much value, especially when you compare it with a two-line exact solution. Of course, when one recalculates this into the real degeneracy, one has to take into account the real spin degeneracy, which gives you extra factor of 2, and the Verley index as well. So there is an extra Verley degeneracy factor of 2. And that's why in the quantum Hall effect, all the steps in the quantum Hall effect measurements, they go with the step of 4 e squared over h. And at high energies, or at high densities, all the steps are 4 e squared over h. But at zero density, where you cross the Landau level at zero energy, when you have j equal to 1 in the monolayer, you just share the step as 2 e squared h and 2 e squared h between electron and hole bands, whereas in the bilayer, you get it as 8 e squared over h shared as 4 and 4 between electrons and holes. And that's what the last slide I have shown you about the measurements represent. And on the basis of that, I think we have discovered a new type of quasiparticle.
Question about this bilayer theorem.
Really necessary?
We haven't had a lot of questions.
Yeah, but that's his fault, so.
Yeah. Do you penalize the audience?
No, I do not want to penalize the next speaker.
Oh. I promise I'll stay till the end of his talk.
It's quick if he has an answer. If he doesn't, then it's also quick. But the question is, with this quadratic dispersion of two bands touching, you might think that this is a very unstable situation.
Yeah. The answer is that it's not the whole truth. The whole truth is that for low momenta, this trigonal warping term, which is linear in energy in momentum, it takes over. And actually, this protects from an absolute infrared instability you would have in a purely quadratic gapless semiconductor. And then the question is whether the electron-electron interaction is stronger or strong enough to take over this velocity V3. Experimental answer is that system does conduct at zero density. So it means it did not take place. I'm not in position to do ultraviolet calculations and to get real numbers. We have some magic problem which is called Siesta, which is now doing some calculation of all the band structure parameters from the first principles. The results are slightly different from one program to the other program, so that I don't completely believe to band structure calculations, especially if they include only the pseudo-potential type of things. But the value of V3 is about 3 to 10 times less than the value of V in the monolayer, which means that it may be that by squeezing or by separating two layers artificially, you can get into the situation of instability and have some excitonic dielectric. But experimentally, it did not take place, so I think that we can forget about that. I have one more word about that. Even if it would take place, if we apply magnetic field and make the magnetic length smaller than the size of the exciton, we have to quantize Landau levels first and then take interaction into account on the level of quantum Hall effect, many body states later. So even then, I would not worry too much about excitonic dielectric because we talk about high magnetic fields.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And I apologize to Uli.